Hi, everybody. Welcome to Wise Talk. This is Mariposa's monthly leadership forum. Today we are excited to have Dr. Dacher Keltner. Dacher is a professor of psychology at the University of California, Berkeley, and the faculty director of the Greater Good Science Center, a renowned expert in the biological and evolutionary origins of human emotion. Dr. Keltner studies the science of compassion, awe, love, and beauty, and how emotions shape our moral intuition. His research interests also span issues of power, status, inequality, and social class. Dacher has shared the stage with the Dalai Lama, counseled Pixar for depicting emotions for the film Inside Out, and has advised Facebook on the use of emoticons. He is the author of the best-selling books Born to Be Good, The Science of a Meaningful Life, The Compassion Instinct, and the book that we're going to discuss today, The Power Paradox, How We Gain and Lose Influence. In addition to more than 100 scientific papers, and he's also done 2 best-selling textbooks. He's an outstanding speaker who has earned many research and teaching awards. He's received rave reviews for his Human Happiness course at UC Berkeley and the online Science of Happiness course that has reached more than 500,000 students worldwide. His work is featured regularly in major media outlets like Time, Newsweek, New York Times, Wall Street Journal, CNN, BBC, and NPR, and The Utney Reader has named him as one of the most visionary people changing our world. He actually was named a top 50 visionary. You can follow the Greater Good Science Center on Twitter. It's at Greater Good SC. So, Dacher, thank you so much for being with us today. I know you're in the state, not traveling today, so hopefully we can be relaxed and not worry about technology today. How are you doing?
That sounds good. I'm doing well. How about yourself, too?
Good. I'm doing well. So I always ask this question, and I'm curious about how you came to the book. You've written a couple books here, but particularly The Power Paradox and your work with the Greater Good Science Center. Tell us a little bit about your career path and how you found yourself in the position you are right now.
Wow. That's a tough question. So, you know, I was lucky to have a unusual childhood, and I was raised by a professor who was my mom, who was kind of a social activist and interested in equality and rights and those kinds of things. And I was also raised by a father who's an artist and, you know, learned a lot about beauty and awe and nature. But I, you know, just from early in life, I was more of a scientist. I liked math and read about dinosaurs and then fell into this science, really, in training with Paul Ekman, who's well known for pioneering the measurement of facial expression. And through studying humans and human emotion up close with facial expression, I got interested in positive emotions like awe and compassion and gratitude. And then I got really interested in the hierarchical dimension of our lives, which, you know, at the time, 20 years ago, 25 years ago, a lot of psychological science was really blind to. We just thought that people lived in this egalitarian state of equality and fairness. And I started through this lens of studying human emotion, started to see how people become submissive and tongue-tied and proud and arrogant. And so that got me to my respective interests of the emotions, and in particular, the moral social emotions like compassion, and then what does hierarchy do to our psyche?
There's lots of things I want to ask you about that because
because your
bio talks about, you know, compassion, awe, love, and beauty, and power. And so
I
obviously you purposely put it in like that. And I'm curious, did you put it in like that because you wanted to sort of juxtapose power? Because power can be thought of as a, you know, negative, can be still thought of as a negative. So tell me a little about that.
Yeah, no, that's really astute, Sue. So, you know, in some sense, there is this, at least at the level of, you know, what the words imply, like love, compassion, beauty, awe, feels like, ooh, those are the lofty things of life. And then there's power, which is pernicious and dangerous and problematic. And I don't think that's the case. And, you know, and I've come to a really different view of power over the 20 years of studying it. You know, I was raised by, you know, kind of utopian idealist who felt like you shouldn't have power in society. And I actually feel like power is part of every moment of our life.
Mm-hmm.
And we have to figure out how to put it to good use. We have to figure out how it brings out the better side to our human nature. So I think the juxtaposition that you're pointing out that I may have sort of inadvertently done is misguided, you know, and that we have to think about how we can be both powerful and compassionate, or be powerful and still be wonderstruck by the world. So I think it's a really provocative comment.
Yeah, I do want to talk about the book, but I wanted to just tell everybody on the call that, and those of you who are listening beyond this call, that this year we picked you particularly to kick us off. So
great.
Doing that. Yeah.
Yeah.
And I'm in agreement with you. I think that power and influence is in everything we do and every day. And
yeah.
And so I'm interested to know a little bit more about how you look at the paradox. So if you could start us by talking about the power paradox and why, you know, describe it and then talk a little bit about why it matters to you.
Yeah, you know, so 20, 25 years ago, I just, you know, it was interesting too. I was studying as a young postdoc, and I got interested in the emotion of shame. And
mm-hmm.
in the United States, shame is this toxic, problematic emotion that really undermines people's well-being. And you cannot help but when you look at people who feel shame or ashamed of their lives, that they feel submissive and they feel without dignity and without humanity, and they feel powerless. And when I looked at that emotion through the lens of psychology, there wasn't a kind of a coherent account 25 years ago of what power does to our emotions or our thought patterns. And so I started this line of work 25 years ago, and one question I was asking is, how do you get power? You know, if you drop, you know, me into a social context, how much influence am I going to have? And I do define power, like you nicely say, as influence, and we can talk about that. And what we found is the first part of the power paradox, which is that, you know, time and time again in studies, and this has been replicated in a lot of different places, you get power in most of the contexts that we live today by connecting to people, by lifting them up, by being creative, by putting out a bold idea, by doing things that advance the greater good, right? And that, you know, as I started to document that scientifically, that was true of the writings of historians and people like Michel Foucault. And then here's the other side of the paradox, which is that, you know, so we get power by lifting people up and by really listening carefully and connecting and developing strong ties. But then regrettably, another line of studies I was doing was finding, you know, once you give someone power, or you make them feel like they are at the top of the hierarchy or better than other people,
mm-hmm.
they lose all the skills that got them power in the first place. You know, they start acting offensively and swearing and unethically, and we could talk about the studies. So that's the paradox, which is, you know, it takes your best stuff to get power, and then you lose the stuff once you have power. So, and you know, when I would teach this to people out in the world and leaders, they're like, "Yep, that's the great story of my organization or my career is, you know, just keeping your edge to avoid the power paradox."
Well. Do you think that happens because, if I understand you correctly, it's like once you get power, then you lose the skills, you forget them, or you choose not, actually, I don't know if you forget them so much as you just choose not to use them. Some of it may be conscious, some of it may be unconscious, but that you've got the power and therefore you decide to be, you know, not as compassionate or more short with people or, you know, limiting people more than you should. I think, and frankly, it's part of why, you know, my company and many of those people on this call, what their work exists, because when people are in power and they don't engage people, then they do feel shorted or slighted or not involved. And I mean, you know, all the movements that are going on right now are in direct, you know, response to that.
Yep, absolutely.
So what do you think is going on when people get into a power place or position? And we're going to assume that we're talking about position right now, not so much personal power, but we're talking about positional power. This idea of forgetting or stopping or whatever word you want to use, what's going on there? Why do you think people do that?
Well, you know, this is why the neuroscience.
Yeah,
you know, and I really lean on the neuroscience here, and it's really instructive. You know, you look at somebody who's abusing power, and I detail these studies. Like, they forget people's names, they stereotype other people, they swear at them, they make sexual passes at them, they, you know, they act like sociopaths sometimes. And, you know, the temptation is to, like, pathologize them or to, you know, think of them as beasts or what have you. But, you know, what the neuroscience tells us, and I think the story is both simpler and more optimistic, and also at the same time optimistic, which is, you know, your brain, when it scans social situations, part of what the brain is devoted to is really thinking about other people, you know, and thinking what they're thinking, figuring out what they're feeling, anticipating their actions, adapting your behavior to other people. And that's really what as you rise in the ranks, that's what, you know, non-human primates and humans do, is as we're trying to make it in an organization or a new community, you're really thoughtful and careful and empathizing and listening carefully and taking in every word of people. And you're, those parts of your more other-oriented regions of your brain are active. And then there's this big switch once you have powerful where you turn away from other people and you start thinking about, like, what do I want? You know, what's in this for me? And where can I gratify my desires? And some of the neuroscientific studies were showing, like by Naomi Eisenberger, when I listen to other people, those empathy regions of the brain are activated. But when I listen to other people and I feel powerful, they're not activated, right? So suddenly you're a little bit blind to the people around you. You're not attending carefully to their emotions. And you lose your edge, and it's costly.
Yeah, I was going to say, as you were talking, I was listening, and I was thinking it was about adjustments. So it's almost like they're losing the edge is like they're losing their ability to adjust. Because when you're rising the ranks, you're like, are looking, you know, you're noticing, you're more motivated to adjust your behavior in order to fit in or
exactly
someone or whatever. Whereas when you get more powerful in the organization, you rise, and, you know, it's still that way, even in flat organizations, it's still a rise, it's still a hierarchy. Your incentive for adjusting melts away a little bit, or a lot.
It does, you know, and I think that's one of the signs of healthy organizations and social systems, right, is keep those incentives in place to make sure the power holders are staying sharp, right, and... Mm-hmm. You know, and that's when, you know, when you study organizations that really start to falter because of the myopia and blindness of their leaders, it's that they're not holding them accountable. They're not incentivizing careful scrutiny or good work. And so that's one of the challenges to face.
I think that the leaders that I find to be the most successful are the ones, no matter where they are in the organization, but let's just say the ones that are higher up in the organization, if they stay curious, and learn, that's probably going to allow them to be more, allow them to adjust more and allow them to be more engaging. I'm probably making it a little bit too simple, but I think that the curiosity is a key. We talk about self-awareness, and we talk about emotional intelligence, and I think that those are also important, but I think if you can stay curious, then you can't help but to learn, you can't help but to adjust. I mean, it's sort of written into to that idea, I guess.
Yeah, you know, and that's empirically shown to be the case, as I write about in the Power Paradox. And the other one that really matters is people who keep their power and don't make these mistakes tend to really care about other people. You know, they tend to really prioritize service or kindness or compassion. So I think, you know, we got to return to those kind of ancient forms of virtue.
Right. Interesting. Okay, so what I want to do now is, before we open it up for questions, is I want to talk about the 20 power principles. So there's 20. Now, I'm going to already tell you, like, why is there 20 and not 7? Or 6? Like, why is there so many?
I know.
How did you decide that there was 20?
Well, you know, in part it's arbitrary, but I think it was by the questions that we need to answer about power, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so one question is, what is it in the 21st century? And I don't think it's funding so much. I don't think it's military might. I don't think it really is about, you know, advancing the welfare of others and influence. So I needed some principles that help us make sense of what is power. You know, and then a second question is, okay, you know, how do I get it? And so there are a set of principles there, and then, you know, there are principles about keeping it, which matter a lot, and then principles about, you know, how do we think through the lens of science and, you know, rigorous analysis, like, why do people abuse power all the time? Why is this sexual harassment scandal so pervasive? And how do we think about this in a very straightforward psychological way? So I had principles of abusing power. And then, you know, it's funny, too. You asked me about, like, why I wrote this book. And part of it was this really interesting experience I had where I grew up, my mom and dad being kind of experimental. My mom got her first job at Sacramento State University, so we moved out into the country in 1970 and into this really poor rural town where people were really poor and struggling.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel that any theory of power has to have principles that account for the effects of not having power and not mm-hmm. being able to contribute to society and make a difference. And so my last set of principles are those, which is, how do we think systematically about the psychology of feeling powerless, which is an important thing.
Right, and I, again, this is so, one of the reasons why we chose you is because your stuff is so apropos. I mean, it would be apropos
yeah.
any time, but it's especially apropos right now. And in fact, when we chose you, it wasn't as apropos as it went actually right this moment.
My God, yeah.
So I do want to talk about that, because I think that there's a societal, so
yeah.
much of what you're talking about is societal, and even though most of what we want to refer to here is about business, and organizations,
yeah.
I want to talk a little bit about these principles. Is there a particular, I mean, there's 20 of them, I'm not going to go through all of them, but
sure.
let me just read them. For those of you who are not on online and don't have access to them, let me just read them, and then I want to go back and let's choose a couple of them and talk about them.
Sure.
So number one is, power is about altering the states of others. And that's not state of others, that's states of others. That's interesting. Power is part of every relationship interaction. Power is found in everyday actions. Power comes from empowering others in social networks. Groups give power to those who advance the greater good. Groups construct reputations that determine the capacity to influence. Groups reward those who advance the greater good with status and esteem. Groups punish those who undermine the greater good with gossip. Enduring power comes from empathy. I definitely want to talk about that one. Let's
yeah.
make sure we do that. Enduring power comes from giving. Enduring power comes from expressing gratitude. Enduring power comes from telling stories that unite. Power leads to empathy deficits and diminished moral sentiments. Power leads to self-serving impulsivity. Power leads to incivility and disrespect. Power leads to narratives exceptionalism, that's hard to say, exceptionalism.
Mm-hmm.
Powerlessness involves facing environments of continual threat. Stress defines the experience of powerlessness. Powerlessness undermines the ability to contribute to society. And finally, powerlessness causes poor health. Yeah. So let's talk about power and empathy.
Yeah.
Power, enduring power comes from empathy. And I think that the key here is the idea of enduring.
Yeah.
Sustaining. Say more about that.
Well, you know, it's so interesting. And, God, you got right to the heart of it, too. So I appreciate it. You know. So, you know, in the trajectory of our lives, in the trajectory of a leader, an executive, or a politician, or scientist, or an artist, you kind of have this, you know, you have this peak moment where you're really, you've mastered your competencies and your skills, and then you're managing, or you're making your mark in the world. And a lot of people then fall, you know, and they, as we're seeing today in politics and in the public sphere, and you do unethical things, and you get into trouble, and you lose the respect of the people around you. And if you really look at the, you know, when I looked across history and I thought about the people that I work with, the people who really have enduring long forms of influence in the world, even past their own mortality, they're great practitioners of empathy. You know, they just listen with passion and they are care about, like you said, they're curious about other people. And when they empathize with their teams are better. And so that only augments their power. It's people like Abraham Lincoln. You know, when you look at the biographies of Lincoln, the singular thing they say about him is the guy was empathetic, right? One of my heroes is Charles Darwin. And Darwin was really kind and modest, but he learned enormous amounts just by being empathetic and listening to, so for example, pigeon breeders in England, who most scientists wouldn't, you know, spend the time with, but they told him a lot about evolution. So I feel like if you want one thing to keep up your influence over your kids or your work colleagues or the people in your discipline or your community, it's really to be a great listener and to be a great practitioner of empathy.
Okay. I'm going to take a couple more and then I'm going to open it up a little bit.
Sure.
Tell us a little bit more about, because I don't know what you mean by this word, power leads to narratives of exceptionalism. I can't even say it. So talk about that more.
Well, you know, this is there's kind of a parallel here, and you know, I was doing research on informal groups, right, like sports teams or sororities or fraternities or young college students joining their dorms, and it's back to like this first question I started asking, which is, who really gains power? And one of the things that I found, both with kids, college students, and summer campers, is the kids who are really good at telling stories, right? That united the kids around them, and everybody's laughing and nudging each other in the shoulder and feeling like they're part of a common cause. The great storytellers that unite rose in power in these studies. And I started to think, wow, isn't that interesting that, you know, one of the ways we gain power in most contexts is just, you know, like some of the famous politicians, you know, from Ronald Reagan to Bill Clinton, who great storytellers sort of unite people and they have influence. Well, the complement or the opposite is also true, which is regrettably one of the things that privilege and power and feeling superior does. You no longer tell stories that unite. You know, we did studies of really privileged people, and their stories of success and life weren't stories that united. They were stories that really were about how exceptional they themselves are, right? And they kept bragging and telling stories about their phenomenal talents and virtues, and they're stories that separate people. And I won't make any political commentary here, but
well,
you know,
we're going to do that in a minute, but and we're going to do it very objectively if we can. There's some of this going on right now. Yeah.
Yeah, and so you know, and that's what we expect. You know, it's interesting when I was teaching out at Lawrence Livermore Labs. You know, the lab leaders there, managing thousands of people. One of the challenges that they told me about was because of the top secret nature of their work, they couldn't tell these stories about the spirit of their organization or their, you know, the lab because of they were prevented from doing so, and it really cost them. So don't underestimate how important it is to really maintain your power to tell these stories about, you know, what the organization means, what the defining values are, how you learn from a failure, right? How you sort of the common qualities that unite people is really a very important part of having influence.
You know, when I coach people to do their presentations, I'm certainly not a presentation like expert, but you know, there's certain things that I say and that are important and enduring in any presentation, which is that you got to tell a story. It doesn't have to be your story, but it has to be, you know, a story. I mean, it could be a story about somebody else. You know, whenever I teach a course on design thinking, I always tell the story from the book of Creative Confidence, and I know it's not my story, but it's such a good story about you know, how a tech went and was trying to fix a MRI machine in a hospital, and he was walking by all the kids that were in line to the MRI machine, and they were all bawling and crying, and and they didn't want to have to go into the big bad machine. And so he took that information back to the engineers and said, you know, how do we make this thing work in a way that the kids aren't going to be so scared? And so it just led to this shift in design in terms of they made the MRI machine a pirate ship, and they made the MRI machine alive. And it's like a simple thing of it just totally helps people understand what design thinking is, because it's like, oh, you understand the product and the perspective from the perspective of the user.
Yeah.
It took somebody walking by and to notice, and the rest is history. But the point is that I, even though it's not my story, I tell it because it's such a good story.
Well, I do that. I know what you're doing, Sue, you know, and I totally agree, which is, you know, and I try to encourage the reader to think about those moments, right, of empathetic insight into the welfare or conditions of others. One of my favorite stories about really massive influence and power, where you wouldn't expect it, is Thomas Clarkson, a young student who's, you know, was writing, he wrote an essay about slavery in the 18th century in England. He suddenly grasped the brutality of the slave ships going from England to the Caribbean and Africa, and he fell off his horse, and he had this insight, like, wow, this is something that's wrong in the world. And he went around telling the story that came out of that empathic curiosity and led to the downfall of slavery. So I do think empathy and storytelling and curiosity are those engines of great influence.
Mm-hmm. So with that, it was a great conversation. Thank you so much. I want to open it up, and if you have a question, Becker, just say your name and your question.
Hi, my name's Andrea. I'm an educator in Northern California. I'm really excited to be on the call, and I have a very burning question I'd like to ask.
Uh-oh.
Our school has recently gone through a pretty considerable power shift.
Yeah.
Both of our school leaders, in the span of about 2 weeks, either were let go or resigned because of that decision. And thinking about how that shift of power has both, I think, brought to the surface issues of distrust, issues of not feeling seen or heard from by leadership. So it really has created quite a bit of chaos in our workplace. Do you have examples of, I guess, situations where that power shift has happened, where there's been a huge change in power, and how communities or workplaces have gotten past that, like where clearly power was abused, maybe power was corrupt and was not used in the best way, and now a community is kind of reeling from that experience?
Yeah, you know,
big question.
And you're... I mean, historically, historians get really worried about power vacuum, right?
Mm-hmm.
Where traditional structures, like, you know, this is very common in the analysis of the rise of Stalin and Hitler, and in particular Hitler, is you have this weird vacuum of power and diminishing of certain institutions, and suddenly you get trouble. And what I would really recommend, you know, in particular when leaders leave for problematic reasons, is to look to some of the restorative justice work and the processes of reconciliation. You know, the Truth and Reconciliation Commission is, I mean, South Africa and Rwanda grappled with the most extreme versions of this.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, genocide and torture and so forth. And it's rooted in nonviolent communication, dignity, airing grievances, and then moving forward. And those are proving, you know, to be really successful tools for communities to, like, as you transition to a new leadership structure, to allow people to air grievances, to figure out sort of a common charter that will unite you? What are the principles that are that define your organization? I would look to that as a model for how to move forward.
That's really helpful, and it's actually funny that you mentioned this because I was listening to a talk recently with Father Greg Boyle from Homeboy
uh-huh.
Ministry, and he yep. talks so much about that, is when you're having to kind of rebuild that this truth and reconciliation and restorative justice is so central to it, and he used the very same examples that you did, so I appreciate that.
Yeah.
That's something that this is now another reminder for me that I need to go back to my history books. And
Convergence. Yeah, and just Google restorative justice,
yeah.
you know, or email me and I'll connect you to people. There's a lot of vibrant work in different kinds of communities.
Great. Thank you so much.
You're welcome, Andrea.
Thank you, Andrea. Who else has a question or comment?
Hey, Sue. Hey, Dacher. It's David. I know both of you a little bit.
Hey, David.
How are you doing, man? So I heard, Dacher, you were in Davos recently. I don't know if
yeah.
you talked about it at all. I had to jump on late client call.
No.
What did you leave Davos with, A, shaking your head in wonderment, and B, encouraged or hopeful about our shared future as a global
yeah.
society?
Wow. Thank you for asking. So I had the Davos World Economic Forum invite professors in, and professors are like, so am I like the jester or the fool, or am I the entertainment, or what am I? You know, because it's a bunch of very well-to-do business people. And I left with a couple of impressions. One, you know, I was on this panel about sexual harassment, and, let's just face facts, you know, sexual harassment is systemic and part of a darker story of sexual violence. And the panel was the most energized panel of the week. And what it told me is women are rising in power. And it's about time. So that was exciting. What was the dispiriting side was the, you know, just it was interesting, David. I was in another panel or a small group where I was talking to a lot of executives about the concentration of power. And what struck me is, A, you know, so one of the things that most people realize when they think about power is it's much more than money, you know. Very often great innovations come out of unfunded labs. Very often people change the world through social movements. Someone can write a book and not make much money and really change how we look at the world. I mean, just anywhere you look in history, power is often independent of financial capital. And Davos doesn't think that way. You know, for them, power is money, period. And I worry about that. What really struck me, because you're navigating this space of like, you know, I saw a bunch of Trump people walk by. Mnuchin, Treasury Secretary, was 2 feet away. You know, and then at the same time, I went to this exhibit on the outside of Davos of being a refugee for a day in the life of the refugee, where they literally throw you into tents and point guns at you, and people are sobbing. And it was put on by former refugees, child soldiers from the Congo. And I was like, you know, they're kind of, in a broad sense, there are a couple versions of power. And one is what one piece of Davos, which is keep it all for yourself and concentrate it, the 1%. And the other is like, let's lift people up, you know. Let's lift people out of poverty. Let's give rights to young girls. Let's protect people from sexual trafficking or whatever it is. So that was both, you know, that's the dispiriting side and also the optimistic side. And then I could talk about Trump, but
well, we're gonna talk about society right now. David, do you have a follow-up at all, or?
I'll put in a plug for a local organization that has served up technology to combat sexual assault, and it's projectcalisto.org. I helped them with a board retreat, but projectcalisto.org, some great women doing great stuff.
All right.
Cheers.
Thanks. Other questions or comments? Okay, we'll come back at the end if we have time. So I do want to talk about the milieu that's kind of here right now.
Yeah.
And you know, you're from you're in Berkeley. I'm in San Francisco.
Yeah.
I mean, it's probably stereotypically, you know, we can probably, everyone on the call could probably figure out what our politics are. So, but that's beside the point. Because I want to have if we can, obviously objectivity is an eye beholder, but I mean, I really think that given what you do and I do, we can have a pretty objective conversation about it. And it's this, why now, in your opinion, why are we in this, let's just call it the Me Too movement, which isn't even a movement. I mean, it became one. I mean, there was Me Too actually way before. Me Too actually, the woman who started it was started a long time ago, but it just it became more obviously prevalent because of the actresses that took it on. So why now, do you think?
Well, you know, it's so interesting too. When I wrote The Power Paradox, at the very end, you know, and I'll be honest, you know, I know I, like everyone else, was totally shocked by the rise of Trump and white supremacy and, oh my God, you know, the return to that. And it's not well anticipated by the book. But toward the end of writing it, I started to dig in deep to the deeper history of power. And what struck me in reading, for example, some archaeologists about their studies of human hierarchies is, about 15,000 years ago, when we moved into these larger settlements out of more nomadic hunter-gatherer tribes, things got really hierarchical, real top-down power. And what you see as we move into these larger settlements is the emergence of, it's really interesting, which is religion, male-dominated power, slavery, and the subjugation of women. And it kind of comes online with this shift in social organization. And I really believe we're at this turning point. And a lot of the historical sociological data line up with this, which is just in the last 50 years in this broader span of history, we've seen the rise of women to, you know, leading countries and getting medical degrees, getting law degrees, you know, 50% of mid-level managers, et cetera. So we're at an inflection point on the gender issue. And the lo and behold, Hillary's supposed to win. And when you get to these inflection points, you're going to have really dynamic things, like, you know, reactions against it, of the rise to women in power.
Mm-hmm.
You're going to see the surface, old patterns like sexual harassment and sexual violence, frankly, which are worldwide universals. Suddenly are looked at anew, like this is totally unacceptable. So I think we have reached the point where it is really, we've hit a critical mass where women are rising to power, and they're going to be old historical, 15,000-year-old historical reactions against it, which we're seeing. And these are ancient historical processes. So it's a great time, you know. It's so dynamic, but it's unsettled.
How do you think companies should respond to that? I mean, I have my own ideas about this, but I want to know your ideas about how companies should respond to this. Because, you know, there's been this before the Me Too, before this last year. You know, there was a lot of talk in tech around the lack of women in engineering, particularly. You know, we had Ellen Poe's situation with Kleiner Perkins. So, you know, these things have been percolating. So, what should businesses be thinking about? People and leaders in businesses be thinking about in terms of this issue?
So, I'm gonna convey two insights. You know, because I used to be kind of flummoxed by that question. Like, what do you do about this taboo topic of offhanded comments and sexual advances and, you know, catcalls and all this stuff that makes up sexual harassment. And there are two insights that come from amazing women leaders that I've had the privilege of being around. One was I was, you know, like David, I was leading this retreat, and these were medical doctors, and it was 50 women, and some of these women are running large branches of Kaiser Permanente, you know, billions of dollars, much more complicated work than I'll ever do. Really, really complicated. And parts of medicine are pretty sexist, right? You know, nurses versus doctors, et cetera. And their troubles around this issue of sexual disempowerment are pretty well known. And this, I was talking to this woman who's one of their medical directors, and she said, you know what we do? We have the no asshole rule. And it comes out of Bob Sutton's book from Stanford. Mm-hmm, and it's just like, mm-hmm. You know, this is our culture, right? We don't make sarcastic, snarky comments. We don't grab people. We don't grab butts. We don't stand really close. We don't roll our eyes in meetings. Period. You know, we don't show pornography at work. And you know, she told me that, and she said it to the group, and the group was like, where are the rules? I'm putting them up. So that's one. Mm-hmm. And then the other one, you know, was at Davos.
Can I stop you a second on that one?
Sure.
It's ridiculous we have to even, you know, even talk about it, right?
Because, I know.
Right? But there's somewhere along the line in that situation, it became clear that, yeah, it's like, and I think the series of things you said are, there's a lot of differences between rolling your eyes and patting somebody on the butt.
Yeah.
Big difference. And that's part of what's going on right now. It's like there's these differences between this variety of sexual assault and variety of harassment. And it's hard. I think it's hard for people to figure out.
It's hard, but we know, right? We know, I don't want my butt grabbed, but you roll your eyes, I'll be a little mad, but I'll calm down for a while. And I can handle that, but you can't grab, you know. So that's one. It's like, and this is back to one of your, Andrea's question, like, what do we do as we transition out of a period of the abuse of power? Is set up a charter of, like, what are the principles you all want to commit to? It's a really good exercise. And Bob Sutton's really strong on this. Like, just don't tolerate asshole-like behavior, excuse the language. And the second point, you know, and this, we were on this panel at Davos, and an executive from Microsoft was talking about there are no more settlements, so people really have to be accountable. You know, there are just these compelling stories. There's a minister from Canada where they have gender equality in their cabinet. And then there was Winnie Byanyima, who is the executive director of Oxfam, really important organization. And she, you know, she comes out of Africa where sexual, like, being grabbed on the butt is small potatoes compared to the violence and persecution that you can find.
Right.
And she's like, you know what? It all boils down to giving women power.
Mm-hmm.
Time is up, man. Let's just give women power. And on her regional directorships, she has equal numbers of women in power. On her, you know, executive team, it's 5 women, 4 men. Just, there's no rational reason why we shouldn't give it generously to women. You know, I was so, just to close out on this, you know, as all this stuff was happening about Me Too and Louis C.K. and Charlie Rose and so forth, you know, I'm friends with Pete Docter at Pixar, and Pixar had its own problems. And what they did is they said, okay, we're going to change our executive team from 1 guy to 6, and 3 of them are women. Right, and suddenly the whole culture, I was there shortly after a Pixar-wide meeting, and the women were, the whole company was uplifted by that giving of women power. So it's deceptively simple.
Yeah.
In some places.
Yeah, I mean, I think that having women in the positions makes it a heck of a lot easier, for sure.
Yeah.
It isn't that hard to do. I say that, but it is hard in some situations to find women engineers. I mean, it's hard to find engineers in general around here, and there just aren't as many. So, it takes a little extra effort. And I think that people, and this is the case for, I mean, not just engineers, but just like people are used to hiring people that makes their friends and just they want to do it the easy way, which understandably, because they're pressed for time. I mean, a lot of what's going on here in terms of power is time and power are so intermixed. I mean, you know, you got to spend more time and go out of your way to look for people that aren't the same as you, whether it's, you know, women or, you know, someone different from you in a lot of different ways. And I think that's part of the issue, that people don't know how to do that. I think I give people a lot of the benefit of the doubt. I think if people knew how to do some of these things, they would do them. They just don't. They just haven't gotten that far in their development or whatever.
But I think, you know, I mean, when you just look at the data and you look at the number of women who are getting degrees in, mm-hmm. you know, even in STEM now, right? It's rising, and
there are
candidates out there. We just have to make mm-hmm. the move.
Right. But I think that we owe it to people to help them, whether it's recruiters or leaders or, I mean, basically, you know, when I coach people and they have somebody that's up in their group, I automatically say to them, okay, so, you know, what are you thinking about? And if it's a woman that they're replacing, then it's, you know, it's more obvious to them that they would replace that person with a woman. But if it's not, I just say, like, well, what are the chances of you going to a different route here and looking at potential women candidates?
Yeah.
And also to
them,
women, people of color and things like that, too. I mean, it doesn't necessarily – it's what are the diversity candidate? Is it whatever different from what they're used to? I just say it as a gentle way, a reminder, like, you may want to look at this and get your recruiter to look at it.
I agree.
And it's not – again, it's not that they're don't want to. It's just they're just trying to get it done, you know, as best as they can. So it's like whoever they bring, get from the recruiter, that they'll go, okay, that's great. But they got to tell the recruiter, hey, you go out and find these folks. So last question here. Any other tips or recommendations you can offer us on the call and those who listen after this to outsmart the power paradox? And that's a wonderful way of looking at it. How do we ensure that when we do have power, that we don't become narrow?
Well, you know, I mean, it's my you sound like my editor too, you know, and so the when I teach leadership groups, they're just like, man, how do I do this? Because I see it everywhere, and how do I outsmart this nasty, ironic part of human nature? And, you know, one is what you said earlier, and it really is borne out in the literature, stay curious, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And just marvel at the work that you're doing and keep going deeper. You know, a second is find your sources of humility. I had this great privilege of working with Pete Docter on Inside Out. I think the movie changed mm-hmm. how the world thinks about the mind and emotion
mm-hmm.
more than billions of dollars worth of science.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I remember talking to him after the movie was this enormous success, Academy Award, and he was profoundly humble about it. And I just saw in that humility how he wanted to do more good things, you know. You know, I think that, you know, when you get around leaders who and people in their lives who really keep the focus and keep the edge, they're getting into kindness. You know, they're practicing loving kindness. They have a set of friends that makes them reverential about the privilege of giving to other people. You know, I mean, it sounds hokey to talk like that, but, you know, I kept teaching that from a scientific perspective, and, you know, the people I would teach in the leadership sector were like, well, this is Jim Collins' last level of leadership, is serve, you know. I think it's important to, you know, I've been studying awe a lot lately. And awe makes you humble. It makes you curious. It makes you aware of other people in this really deep way. I think it's interesting how to stay at your best when you have the privilege of power is to find some regular sources of awe. You know, get out there and see some redwoods, or you know, go on a backpacking trip, or go listen to beautiful music. That will kind of fine tune your psychological tendencies. So, you know, there's this old tradition that goes back to Aristotle, which is power is part of life, and we have to cultivate good power. You know, we have to look to things that make us humble or curious or reverential, and I think that's starting to find light in the scientific study of power.
Mm-hmm. That's great. Well, Decker, you've been lovely. Thank you so much for your insights. It's been really wonderful to have you on, and a great way to start the year here in our topic of influence. Can people get a hold of you through Twitter or through email? What's the best way for them to get
hold of you? Through email, keltner@berkeley.edu. And thank you, Sue.
Keltner at, what is it called? What was it, your email again?
Keltner@berkeley.edu.
Easy. Okay. And again, your Twitter account is @greatergoodsc. And tell us, before we leave, what is the Greater Good Science Center? Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, you know, I mean, the Greater Good Science Center, we've been working at it for 15 years. There's a staff of 12. We take all of this science. We write wonderful essays. We get them out. We host workshops. We have a summer institute for teachers and educational leaders. But it's just, if you're curious about, you know, gratitude or kindness or mindfulness or stress or awe, the site is one of the best in terms of getting you wonderful knowledge in those realms.
It sounds great. And is there a website that I can go to learn more about the center?
Yeah, sorry, that's greatergood.berkeley.edu.
So I want to, again, thank you very much for being with us today. I really appreciate it. And I also want to let people know about our next Wise Talk. It is, again, the last day of the month on the 28th. We have Chris Nadherny with us. And, again, we'll be talking about influence throughout the year. We've got scheduled out probably 4 months at this point. If any of you on the call know of people who have books or papers on influence and would be a good Wise Talk guest, we welcome you to let us know. And you can get a hold of Allison at MariposaLeadership.com, and she'll field the email for you. Thanks again, and everyone have a wonderful rest of the week, and we'll see you next month. Thanks again, Docker. Bye.
Thanks, Sue.